So it's one of the questions we were given. Why do we have so many different translations of the Bible? Does that mean we don't really know what it is said, and therefore how can we trust it? Good question, isn't it? At the turn of last year, Newsweek magazine in the US, so this is the Christmas edition they had, produced a double issue in which it declared, you can still find it online, and in the most forthright of terms, that Christians were ignorant of the Bible, they misread and misused it, and that basically the whole thing was so unreliable a text as to be completely unusable. We were all reading from a copy of a translation of a translation, and it was all a complete waste of time, which kind of reflects some of where this question is coming from in that staff room. And then it finished the article by quoting Jesus saying, "Judge not so that you will not be judged," the favourite verse of the world, and saying that perhaps we should start listening to what the Bible's really got to say. Judge not, lest you be judged. Now, I don't know about you, but it can be disconcerting when a national magazine comes out with that. It's a huge, long article, about 24 pages, I think. It was a major edition they brought out, where they're saying things like, is the Bible really reliable? Are there so many translations that we don't really know what should be in it at all? Are we just kind of picking and guessing? In short, why trust it? Should we trust the Bible and the text that we have at the moment? And this was a national magazine bringing this out. Now, there are some excellent responses online to that Newsweek article, which, if you've come across it at all and have been unsettled by it, they expose the article for what it is, which is a very shoddy piece of journalism. Daryl Bock on the Gospel Coalition website gives an excellent response to it. Michael Brown on Newsweek.com itself gives another very good response, which basically says it's about as badly researched a piece of writing as you could hope to find. It takes nothing seriously. It flies in the face of the consensus of modern scholarship, both Christian and otherwise. It misrepresents things, and it's little more than an irresponsible polemic against the Bible, basically, although it claims not to be. And it's also internally inconsistent as an article. So for a piece which spends so many pages trying to suggest that we do not know what the Bible really said at all, which is its basic thesis, to finish off by saying, therefore, we should listen to what the Bible says here, is supremely ironic, isn't it? Listen to the bit that we like and ignore the rest is kind of where it's going. But underneath all that rubbish of the Newsweek article, don't bother to go and read it up, it's really not worth it, there is an important question. Can we trust the Bible as we have it, as the Bible as was originally written? And given the huge numbers of Bible translations available, how do we know who's right? Is it just kind of pick and mix? Well, let's start with the text as we have it. How reliable is it? And the simple answer is, it's astonishingly so, particularly in comparison with other classical works that are around. So we'll think about the New Testament primarily this evening, just briefly. It's true we haven't got any original comments, any original copies. There's no kind of signed off with Paul scribbling in his large handwriting. But we do have manuscripts that date right back to within 100 years of the text being written. They're fragments, but they're fragments that cover an extensive portion of the New Testament. And that is very early manuscript evidence in comparison to other classical works. So the table you've got on the screen there, you see it? Yeah, there we go. Compares the manuscripts that we have of the New Testament with other classical writing, showing both the number of manuscripts that there are surviving and the dates where that are closest to when the originals were written. Does that make sense? And you can see the New Testament comes off pretty astonishingly well compared with the other classical texts that there are around. So that means, because of the sheer number and quantity of manuscripts that we've got, that scholars have been able to compare them to determine what was the original. So the more copies that you get, the more sure you can be that what you come up with is the right, is the correct thing, because there you'll be able to kind of sift out the ones that are just wild and wacky and completely out of it completely. So there are 5,700 manuscripts, not all from that period of that first 50 years of the second century AD, but there are plenty of manuscripts that there are around. Now, if you compare across all those textual manuscripts, there are variants between them, but you'd expect that, wouldn't you? They weren't printed from a printing press. They don't all come out identical. They're copied. So there are some textual variances between them. But the simple fact is that many of those variants are simply differences in word order. And word order is not as significant in Greek as it is in English. So a word change around doesn't actually change the meaning of the sentence. It's a variant between different manuscripts, but it's not significant. Or maybe something like leaving out the definite article. There's no the in one manuscript, and there is in another one. doesn't make any difference to the understanding, and isn't necessary in the Greek. But it changes nothing of the essential text that we have before us. There's widespread unanimity. There are a few of those textual variants that affect meaning. So let me give you one example. Romans chapter 5, verse 1 could read one of two things. It could read, "Let us have peace," or it could read, "We have peace." And the difference in the Greek is one letter. That's all the difference that it makes. But it's hardly a major textual discrepancy between the two. So the result is the two understandings. One would be Paul describing our status with God. We have peace. The other would be Paul urging his readers to experience this harmony with God. Let us have peace. Now, either of those things could be true, and both of those things would chime in with what the rest of the New Testament has to say. So it doesn't actually make a massive difference doctrinally for either of them. And the significant thing is that none of the textual variances across all those manuscripts impact on any kind of major doctrine. And there are only two substantial passages in the New Testament which there are questions. One is in John chapter 7, verse 53, to chapter 8, verse 11, which is the woman caught in adultery. And the other one is the last few verses of Mark chapter 16, the end of Mark's Gospel. And if you notice, as you read through your NIV or your ESV or whatever it is, you'll always find those two passages bracketed. And a little footnote at the bottom to say the earliest manuscripts we have don't have these things that are there. So it's acknowledged up front by the scholars that there are questions where they are around. So the textual evidence of the Bible is excellent. We know that what we have is what was originally written. But the next question, I guess, is what about all the translations then? We've got the NIV and the ESV and the Good News Bible and the New American Standard Bible, and you could go on and on. Well, one reason for those many different translations is that different translators take a different approach. So some will go for a very literal translation. This Greek word means this, and so we'll put it in word for word. So the ESV, the English Standard Version, would be a literal translation. But sometimes that can make the English feel slightly awkward in terms of its reading style, because it's just transliterated from the Greek. Others go for what's called a dynamic equivalence translation, which is what the NIV does, which is the one that we use here, of course, which seeks to put words and idioms into modern equivalents. So weights and measures would be one example of that, where they've translated into kilos and feet and inches and all that kind of thing, which is obviously not the measurements that were being used in the first century, back in the first century and before. So take this example from 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 16. So the ESV puts it this way. "From now on, therefore, we regard no one according to the flesh. Even though we once regarded Christ according to the flesh, we regard him thus no longer." That's the literal Greek, according to the flesh. That's what the Greek words mean. The NIV puts it like this. "So from now on, we regard no one from a worldly point of view. Though we once regarded Christ in this way, we do so no longer." Do you see the difference that's been made? The NIV has sought to put it in words that will make more obvious sense to us in our modern translation. We don't use the word flesh like that anymore. But what it means is according to the worldly way of thinking, which is why the NIV has translated it in that way. Now there are others then which are free translations or paraphrases, like the Living Bible or the Message, which aren't actually translations and they don't claim to be. They're kind of paraphrases, putting it into colloquial English, but aiming to give an overall sense of the passage. And they can be very helpful, but they're not trying to do exactly the same things that things like the NIV and the ESV are doing. But if you compare, for example, the ESV and the NIV, they will sound different, often in style, but also they'll sound much the same. And their meanings will tally up. They're different in style, but not in essential substance. And in fact, the commitment to doing a good job of understanding the original text is shown by the translators' ongoing revision of their work. So the NIV Committee of Translation, for instance, meet every year to review once again to see how scholarship has moved on and how use of language has moved on, and to review the translation, which is why we had that recent reissue of the NIV back in 2011, was it? There was a whole new edition came out to reflect changes in scholarship, greater understanding, and changes in the way in which we use language today. And the other thing to encourage us as we think about being confident in the text is to see that there's the inclusion of footnotes throughout our Bibles, which can cause great fun in the midst of Bible studies, can't they? But they're always there to show where there are significant textual variances that are there. So there's nothing being covered up. There is no Da Vinci Code conspiracy where people are sneaking it away. Actually, Bible scholarship, evangelical Bible scholarship that produces things like the ESV and the NIV, acknowledges those things, and so therefore we can be confident in what goes on. One last thing just to mention on this is to think about, well, what about examples such as the New World Translation, which the JWs use? I don't know if you've ever seen one of those. Well, if you read that, there are certain passages in the New World Translation which read very, very different to the NIV or the ESV or the RSV or whatever else it might be. Because the New World Translation is driven by a particular theological concern that the JWs have, which is to deny the deity of Christ. So therefore they translate certain passages with that in mind, driven by the theological idea rather than by what the text is actually saying. So let me give you an example. In John 1:1, where the word is God in our NIV, ESV, in the New World Translation, the word is a God, where the A has been added in. It's not there, but they've added it in, because otherwise Jesus is divine, and they don't believe that. So there's no definite article in the original Greek, and there's no reason to insert one given the context. And actually, of course, adding in that definite article of the A creates more problems for the JWs, because you seem to have more than one God, which they would be very keen to avoid. But the whole tenor as you read through John's Gospel points towards the deity of Christ. So let me give you an example. Chapter 8, verse 58, Jesus states, if you remember there, before Abraham was born, what does he say? I am. The significance of that? Well, I am is the name that God chooses in the Old Testament, and he's very deliberate in picking that up. So the New World Translation translates that as I have been, which takes away the divine claim through it. But in doing so, that's not consistent with the translation for the rest of John's Gospel. So where Jesus says, I am the bread of life, I am the light of the world, I am the resurrection and the life, wherever it is, they translate, I am, not I have been. In order to show the consistency, you need to have I am still in there. And most significantly, of course, their translation, I have been, doesn't explain why the Jews promptly pick up stones to stone him. They do that because he has just been a blasphemer. He has just claimed to be God. He has said, I am. He has taken the name of God on himself. I have been would have just left them going, that's a bit weird. I am means you want to stone him because he's a blasphemer. So it doesn't fit together. So the New World Translation is driven by a particular desire to make a theological point and therefore is not reliable, in contrast to the other translations that we use.